Blog Talk Radio.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the art of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is make the leader in you come alive.
You're listening on cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Thanks for joining us. Friends, no matter if you are the teacher or the student, the lawyer or the judge, no matter the role, you have a purpose and you're a leader in that purpose. Our goal here is simple, to inspire and equip all to lead where they are. In other words, get us on cue with God's will, on cue with his calling on our lives, which is our purpose, and get others on cue with that purpose. What is cue? It's C-U-E. It's how Nehemiah, a model transformational leader, led a starved, desperate, broken, isolated people in building a wall and closing the gaps around ancient Jerusalem. He C-U-E'd them up. And C stands for common ground. It's what we can agree on. It's why we've come together. U is a unified thought. What vision can we share? Is that what we intend to do? E, equally yoke. What's the game plan? What's success look like? What's my role in it? How we work together? It is the how. So Q leadership broadly integrates biblical principles of leadership and change and communications using Nehemiah as the model and helping you do two things. One, get people to trust you. And two, get people to follow you in discipleship. So trust and discipleship is at the very axis of leadership. So as we always do, well, I want to start our show with a prayer. So Lord, you are powerful, merciful, living God. Lord, we just thank you for this day, and Lord, and lead and bless this ministry and all that, and our audience and all that are serving you. Lord, we know that this Q leadership is your brainchild, but our calling in your name, we honor you today by doing two things, by giving you the glory, and two, serving this generation through Q. Lord, your word shares in Romans 12:2, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Lord, use this ministry to complete that purpose, to align and equip and transform some new leaders for your glory. Help others hear the call and receive the call and raise some transformation leaders and gatekeepers in your name. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. So what do we expect today? We always try to have a dialogue, a conversation about leadership based in God's word. We try to equip leaders with a roadmap to tap into faith in order to build that trust and then to build that discipleship. And we like to highlight everyday leaders who are making a difference that can testify to God's goodness and their own transformation. Our show is a lot of things, but it is not to criticize, but to shine a light on some truth and love. It's not to tell you what to do, provide a different lens on in order to see things. And it's not to focus on mere symptoms of a problem, but to get to the root of the problem. In a sense, treat the infection, not the runny nose. So today, as with any day, let's pray that we hear the Lord and not me. We have the right questions, and no matter what the differences may be, remember that this life is about love and surrender. And there will be differences of opinions, of course, but let us do what a true transformation leader says. Let us agree without being disagreeable and be thought partners and have a fruitful dialogue so we can progress this generation to one condition to the next. So, friends, we thank you for joining us tonight again and bearing with us on last week. We did not get a chance to broadcast, and I pray that the Lord forgives us on that as well. You know, the main reason for not making the show was due to work, of course. It was pretty tough. The last few, two or three weeks was pretty tough, where my firm specifically was involved in an assessment of a major merger acquisition, major transaction, and we were helping them, this one firm, to invest in another. But that's what I do in professional work as a managed consultant, and I lived through a few of these types of transactions, even growth strategies, even which also includes performance improvement, corporate transformations. As I said, M&A, and one of the reasons, and that's really the reason we didn't do the show last week, as I shared. But you know, when you think about those programs, is up about 70% of these programs or transactions don't really achieve the expected financial or performance or strategic results. Some begin with flawed assumptions, insufficient planning, and also end with poor execution or some cultural conflicts, misaligned metrics. and even just bad leadership. However, some firms consistently do this kind of growth very well. How do they succeed, though? In my experience and in colleagues' experience, just polling different individuals across the industry, leadership is successful. And successful companies begin by first confronting a certain reality, and that reality is recognizing that people-related decisions present the most difficult variable and pose the most greatest risk to any type of growth, transformation, performance improvement, or even just running your everyday business. Decision-making can cripple any growth or any value created, no matter where you are. If you're in the church, you're in your small business, you're in McDonald's, you're in your home, no matter where it is, decision-making is so key. Whether the goal is to return on investments through acquiring and expanding customer relationships, generating new channels, creating new products, building new capabilities, just gaining some efficiencies in their operations, or even improving student test scores. What's key to success in all these things is putting the right people in the right places and empower them with the right authority to make those decisions. Let me say that again. The key to those successes is putting the right people in the right places and empowering them to make the right decisions. And the opposite also is true, though. What is key to failure is putting the wrong people in the right places and empower them to make the right decisions, right authority with the right decisions. But when the variable is the wrong people, people began to make decisions that begin that failure we talked about, the key to failure. And failure lots of times happens in because of two reasons. One, incompetence. The individuals who have in those places, in those right places, are not necessarily ready. And the second one is imprudence. Those individuals, the wrong people you put in those right places, you make unethical, immoral, irreverent decisions. Like what we see in countless corporate corruption instances, government corruption at federal, state, and local level, and anywhere, and like what's been revealed in Atlanta over the last couple of years and really has come to an end on this past week. It's been an incredible criminal cheating trial in Atlanta, has sent school teachers to prisons and administrators to prisons for violating a law originally enacted to go after mobsters. Prosecutors used the Georgia's Racketeer Influence and Corruption Organizations, the RICO law, to convict former principals, teachers, administrators of trying to boost their bonuses by conspiring to artificially raise kids' test score. That sounds familiar from a corporate America perspective, right? And there's dozens of educators are on trial and gone to prisons up to sentenced from weekend trials up to I think almost 20 years, I believe, or more. But during the closing arguments on Tuesday, though, a lawyer for the defense suggested that it was ludicrous abuse of power to bring in racketeer charges against school teachers, as some of the news reports came out on this week. But others suggest that the accused got what they deserve. You know, but after 2 years, after dozens of indictments, a jury found these former teachers and educators guilty of conspiring to change students' tests, among other things. We'll hear more about that today. But the verdicts closes a dark chapter on Atlanta City school system, but also opens another chapter that suggests that the sentences were too stiff, you know, which leads to our question of the day. Who received the stiffest sentence? Helping us with that is our special guest. We're very excited to have her, attorney Ruth Rocker McMullen. She's a partner in Mull and McMullen LLC. It is an Atlanta-based firm. Ruth represented one of the defendants in case, full disclosure. She also serves as adjunct professor at Emory School of Law and is a magistrate judge in Gwinnett County. Ruth and her husband, Vaughn, they live in Gwinnett County in the Atlanta area, and where they're raising a 7-year-old daughter and 3-year-old twins. She's a fellow alumnus of mine from JSU. She graduated with honors. will do her BS in psychology and criminal justice, forensic science investigation, and also she's a graduate of Emory University School of Law. Ruth is also a member of the Georgia Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the American Academy of Forensic Science, American Psychology Law Society, the Cobb County Bar Association, Gwinnett Bar Association, and also the Georgia Asian American Bar Association, and also as the Emory Black Law Student Association Alumni Advisory Panel. She comes with a lot of different accolades, and you'll hear her. You'd be absolutely impressed, and as well as want to reach out to her once we're done here. So after the break, we can start our dialogue with our special guest, Atlanta attorney Ruth Rocker McMullen, and who will help us answer the question of the day, who received the stiffest sentence? So during the break, so stay with us, call us to share your thoughts, and stay with us. You can't afford to miss this. To answer a question or make a comment, please press 1 on your telephone, which raises your hand virtually. And the number, by the way, is 310-861-2331. That's 310-861-2331. You're welcome to call, and you're also welcome to log in our live chat room to share what's on your mind. And my daughter, producer, assistant, and navigator here, Kennedy, can chat with you and bring you into the discussion as well. So, friends, we would love to hear from you. Please call us again. The number is 310-861-2331. This is On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back.
How do you lead a people who are starved, who are broken, who are isolated?
You lead them where they are by getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
Powerful is your leadership. Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on the cue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the art of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is makes the leader in you come alive.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
It should be a mandatory part of every church pre-membership class, every school leadership program. I think this curriculum effectively used not only positions a person for better leadership, but positions a person for better life.
Thanks for staying with us. You're listening on cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Remember, our mission here is simple, friends, to help you leave where you are by getting you on cue with God's will and His calling on our lives. So today's question, who received the stiffest sentence? We're talking about the recent case in Atlanta where the school administrators were sentenced to for racketeering and changing tests for student test scores on some standardized tests on this past few years. Helping us with that is our special guest. It's an attorney, Ruth Rocker McMullen. She's a partner in Mull and McMullen out of Atlanta-based law firm. Ruth, as I introduced before the break, is representing one of the defendants in the case. She serves as an adjunct professor at Emory School of Law. She is a magistrate judge in Gwinnett County. And Ruth and her husband, Vaughn, resides in Gwinnett County, where they're raising a 7-year-old daughter and 3-year-old twins. And I've also failed to say that she's also a fellow Sister of the Blue, Phi Beta Sigma, and I have to make sure I put that out there. So, Ruth, thanks for joining us. Give her a virtual round of applause, everybody.
Thanks for having me, Eric. You know I was going to mention that.
Of course. You know, that's where we connected almost 20-something years ago, and it's good to reconnect on this medium here tonight.
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks for joining us. I know we probably got a lot to cover, and we could potentially make this a whole series of shows based upon this element, because there's so many rich nuggets in this case, Ruth. But we'll try to get started as we normally do. What we always try to do is try to let the audience kind of peek inside of Ruth just a little bit at the beginning of our show to kind of get connected. So we always start our show with a same two questions as I share with you. And the first one is, Ruth, is, you know, what is that one word that describes you?
I had to ask my husband, because the first word that came to my mind is busy, but I know that's kind of that's not as easy to understand. So I asked him, and he said tenacious. And
tenacious.
I would agree. I think, man, tenacious. Although it makes me sound like, you know, a pit bull or something, you know, grab hold and won't let go. But I think that's fairly accurate.
Okay. I can see that. So Ruth, related to that, though, if money was no issue, you know, what would you do every day?
I don't think I could just sit back and relax and do nothing. I would probably prefer to focus my time and efforts on nonprofits locally and internationally. That's something I've really developed a passion for in law school. It's just that after I was graduated and came out owing more than I owed on my house, I really couldn't afford to take a job at a nonprofit. But that's ultimately where I'd like to go back to, is the nonprofit world.
Right. And so can you tell us a little bit why abroad as well? Is it mostly connected to your background from that perspective? Can you share?
Well, yes. You know, it is kind of connected to my background. My mother is from Vietnam. I was born in Vietnam, and I haven't been back since I was born. But my mother went back about 10 years ago. And she went back to her village, and, you know, they made arrangements to bring in rice for everybody in the village, and that was seen as something so heroic, and it cost my mother and her family very little to do, but you would have thought they were going to rename the city after them. And it's just amazing the small things that here in the States we take for granted that
Wow.
are enormously appreciated in other countries.
Right. What an amazing perspective. And if you all could get that, that would be, I think it would improve things tenfold, all the things we're talking about. Wow.
Right.
Thanks for sharing that.
And the other issue is my daughter, our oldest daughter, was born with albinism. So she is, what people would call albino.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing some research about it once we figured out that's what it was. Because it wasn't readily apparent. And as I was doing research trying to understand, because she has a mild form of it, I was trying to understand her condition, I came across a charity in Tanzania, and there happened to be a huge story about the issue with albinism in Africa, and kids are getting hunted down and killed there because of their condition.
Right. Yeah, I can remember seeing a documentary. I think Kennedy and I watched some years ago. Because of that, it's considered a lucky luck charm,
right,
or so forth, related to that.
Right.
That may be another story for us to come back on and talk about sometime soon.
Exactly.
And thanks for sharing those two personal elements. And again, it's just a way to help people understand and pierce to know the soul of Ruth, right? But you relate to that. Tell a bit more about you personally, your family, and as well as leading to professionally.
I was born in Vietnam, but I was raised in Alabama. Went to Jacksonville State University in Alabama, and after I graduated, I decided that I kind of worked my way into law school as really a default. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, so one of the professors in the criminal justice department highly suggested I take the LSAT and give it a try. And so it was kind of on a whim. I said, well, okay, why not? I gave it a try, and I only applied to two schools. I applied to Georgetown and Emory, got accepted to both, and really felt like I wanted to pay less tuition and be closer to home. And I really liked the people when I went to visit Emory, so I ended up at Emory. During the summer before my last year of law school, I met my husband. He's a native of Atlanta.
Okay.
So we've been dating, although we've only been married for 12 years, we've been dating since 1999. And his family is here. I knew I wanted to stay here. He knew he wanted to stay here. So this kind of worked out where we decided to settle down and, you know, have our family here. So.
Wow. Well, great. Great. And so you have three children, right?
Yes. The oldest is seven, and then we have our twins are almost 3.5. So it's a boy and a girl twins. And they're probably just as precocious as their big sister.
Lots of fun. Well, again, thanks for sharing it. So once you finish law school, of course, stay in the Atlanta area, can you kind of walk us through to where you are now?
Yes. I started as my last year of law school, I started as an intern, student intern at the DeKalb County Public Defender's Office. And before I graduated, they offered me a job there. So I graduated, took the bar, and then started on with them in a paid position as an attorney in 2000. And I was with them for 13 years. And then left and went into private practice. But during the course of the 13 years, I did all litigation or criminal litigation work, which means trial work. It started with misdemeanor trials and having my own misdemeanor caseload, DUI, shoplifting, you know, simple batteries, that kind of stuff. And once I got promoted to Superior Court, which is where we handle felonies, then I did felony trial work. And for 4 years of my time as a felony trial attorney, I did exclusively trial work representing juveniles charged as adults. We call those SB 440s after the Senate bill that made it possible to charge children as adults, which could be another show.
Right.
I spent 4 years representing children. These are children ages 13 to 16 who were facing a possibility of life in prison. So I did that for 4 years, and then I kind of it's highly emotional and really just mentally draining and emotionally draining. So after 4 years, which is a pretty long time to do it, I just had enough. And so I asked to change to another position. So I spent almost two years representing adults who had severe mental health issues and were also in the criminal justice system facing felony charges.
Wow. So juvenile, those you were right in the cusp of those who needed the most, the juveniles as well as the mental health.
Yeah.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that. And then, of course, now you're a partner in your own law firm. Can you talk about Amola McMullen?
Yes, actually, my law partner, Corinne Mull, was my supervising attorney when I was a student intern in the public defender's office. She retired from the public defender's office but wasn't ready to retire from practicing law and kind of bounced around the idea of going into private practice, and I happily offered to go with her. This is someone who, she literally taught me everything I knew about being a criminal defense litigator. My office was right next door to hers for years in the public defender's office. Her and her husband are the godparents to our children. So, you know, when she said she was leaving, you know, the job is stressful enough. I couldn't imagine being there without her. So
right.
I said, well, if you want to give it a try, I'll give it a try too. That's how we kind of ended up in private practice together. And we're still only maybe two blocks away from the office where we spent most of our lives.
Wow, wow. Still in with the same connections and so forth. So that's great. Well, congratulations.
Okay.
Taking a step of faith and making it happen, right?
Yeah, we just had to do it.
Do it.
If you wait for the right time, there'll never be the right time. So
and never will. You're always going to have an exceptional excuse not to do it, right?
Right.
Always.
So it's
always.
Can't account for. So, you know, we just had to do it.
Had to do it. We're great. Thanks for sharing that. You know, which also leads to our topic for today, and regarding the Atlanta school trial. And I know that full disclosure, as we share, that you represented one of the clients in this trial. And I know there's certain things I may be able to ask or may not, but it just guide me there. Things you can and cannot share. But just the case in general, you know, when you think about the case in general, what do you think about? What pops in your mind?
You know, every time I hear mention of the case, if I had to describe it visually, there would be this big, giant question mark sandwiched in between a bunch of exclamation points, because I still cannot understand how this all came to be in terms of criminal charges. And I say that because this all started back in 2008 with an investigation by the major newspaper here in Atlanta, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And your listeners are free to, you know, do a Google search on them. They did a multi-part series about cheating and test scores and blue ribbon awards. We've all heard of schools getting the blue ribbon award. So it started with their investigation. They started doing open records requests, looking for test data and grade data in schools. And they did this investigation, and they started doing this open records request nationwide. This was not just Atlanta. This was across the nation that they reported on. Once they started writing their articles and putting it in print, the end result was the same evidence or same peculiar data that led to this case, the APS case as we call it, was found in 69,000 schools.
Wow.
69,000 schools across the nation, including Dallas, including D.C., including New York, in 400 school districts.
Wow.
69,000 schools in 400 school districts, but out of all of those cases, we have one school district where these teachers were charged criminally.
Okay, out of all the cases where...
Out of all the incidents that were reported by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and they did big write-ups naming the schools, naming these schools, naming some of these prestigious schools and affluent neighborhoods in the D.C. suburbs, name them by name.
Wow.
And nothing, no criminal charges came of that. But it came up in Atlanta. So that's why I say there's every time I think about it, the first thing that comes to mind is what made it so different? It was the exact same statistical anomalies, the exact same statistical impossibilities that were cited in the Atlanta case that cropped up all across the nation. They published a map.
Go ahead. They published a map?
They published a map with little red spots to show all the schools and school districts across the nation where these same statistical anomalies appeared.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say statistical anomalies, I mean there were test scores for children whose class grade performances, the test scores are not reflective of their classroom grades. And or their test scores from the prior year. And the test that we're talking about is the CRCT, And the CRCT is administered first through fifth grade. And so what they're saying is, you know, in some of these cases, the same child had a certain test score in second grade, and then their test scores jumped so high in third grade that it's statistically impossible for it to occur without cheating. If their grades in their classroom stayed the same, then how do you get this jump in a standardized test score without intervention?
Okay.
And so that's what I'm talking about. These are the statistical anomalies that the AJC reported that then led ultimately to criminal charges in Atlanta.
Wow. So which do you think, just because it started there in Atlanta? I know you still just got question marks on why Atlanta and not in other places.
I don't know if it was because it started, and I can't say the cheating chronologically started in Atlanta, but it was an Atlanta-based newspaper that exposed it. But there was also a school system in the southern part of Georgia that had the exact same statistical anomalies. Their district attorney ultimately said that this was not a criminal matter.
What was the trigger?
It smacks of politics. It smacks of politics, and deep down, I just believe that the political people in control, I believe that this was the back door, the back story of all this has to do with politics. It has to. How could it just be this one school system where criminal charges are brought out of all of these others?
Wow. You know, as we go through, we're going to get into a little detail regarding this, and we're going to keep that theme in mind of being the only one. Walk us through how the changing the test scores led to racketeering.
Well, I think to understand the racketeer, or to understand that connection that the district attorney's office tried to make, we first have to understand the basic principle of what is racketeering. So racketeering was, you know, as laws developed used to bring down the Gambino family. Since then it's been used to bring down other crime organizations like gangs, street gangs, other mafia-type organizations, and it was because of this. So racketeering says that if you are a part of a corrupt organization and you know you are a part of the corrupt organization, anything that your underlings do, you can also be charged with. Because the way the Gambino family works and the way a lot of these common street gangs work is that the people at the top are not out there doing the crime. They're not out there doing the robberies. They're not out there shooting people. They're somewhere insulated in their home, safe, giving out the orders. And so the laws used to be, if you didn't actually participate in it, then you can't be charged. So racketeering was a way to say, yeah, but we can prove you are part of this organization and your underlings went out and did these things, so therefore you are just as guilty as they are. It is just the same as if you had been in that car and you did the drive by yourself. That's what racketeering allows prosecutors to do. And obviously when you look at it in that context, it serves a purpose. So in this case, the corrupt organization, so to speak, was the school system itself. They're saying if you are a part of this school system, you are part of this corrupt organization. And anything you, your colleagues, your underlings do, equal peers, you can all be charged with it. The goal of that was to get to the top. To Dr. Hall.
Okay.
They wanted Dr. Hall, right? Not these teachers. But in order to get to Dr. Hall, they have to get her underlings. So that's how you have all these teachers charged.
So Dr. Hall was, began all of this.
Right.
Alleged.
Because, Right, because she's the superintendent of the school system. They were never going to be able to say that she, Dr. Beverly Hall, went to any particular school and sat down and changed test scores. That, you know, that never happened. She never, they can never prove that she went in and did that, or that she went in and changed answers, or she went into any, or they can't, they would never be able to prove that she put her hands on any one of those tests. But they wanted to get to her because ultimately she's the leader of this organization. So the only way to get to her is to charge everybody from the bottom to the top with RICO.
Okay. And so she, of course, Dr. Hall has since passed away prior to the end of this trial. But
yes.
It was said that she got $500,000 bonus because of this, and that's what started the whole thing?
Well, you know, that was the state's theory of the motive behind doing all this, was this big, huge bonus that she received. But this big, huge bonus was to her. It wasn't to all these other teachers who ultimately got indicted. Yeah, so that was a big bonus. And, you know, when you think about it, these schools got they got recognition. Some of them got federal money. As a matter of fact, the state of Georgia got $400 million in federal grant money in the federal Race to the Top program.
Mm-hmm.
The state of Georgia incorporated these skewed Atlanta public school test scores with all the other test scores from school districts in the state. They incorporated all this data into their submission and their application for grant money for the Race to the Top. And the state of Georgia was awarded $400 million in that Race to the Top program.
$400 million?
$400 million.
Race to the Top. For being exemplary based upon these test scores.
Quickly improving school systems, quickly improving, you know, failing or you know, less than average performing schools and bringing them up to the standard. The federal government had a race to the top, and that's what it was. Can you prove that, you know, your schools and in your state are getting there and getting the students caught up to where they need to be, and who can do that? Show us your data. State of Georgia used this data. They knew that this data was flawed and there were some problems and questions about it, used this data to get a grant for $400 million.
Wow. You know, when we come back, Ruth, thanks for sharing that. We want to pick up that point on this federal grant money and how it perpetuated the feds coming after the state. And so after the break, we'll continue our dialogue with our special guest, Atlanta attorney Ruth Rocker McMullen, who's helping us answer our question of the day, who received the stiffest sentence. So during the break, please stay with us. Call us at 310-861-2331. Feel free, again, to press 1 on your telephone if you got any questions for Ruth. And that, which is the pressing one, raises your hand virtually. You're also free to log into our live chat room, ask Kennedy a question. She can bring that into the conversation as well. So we'd love to hear from you, friends. Please call us at 310-861-2331. This is On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back.
By getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on the cue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the art of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is makes the leader in you come alive.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
It should be a mandatory part of every church pre-membership class, every school leadership program. I think this curriculum effectively used not only positions a person for better leadership, but positions a person for better life.
Back. Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Our mission here is simple, friends. They help you leave where you are by getting you on cue with God's will and His purpose on our lives. So today's question, who received the stiffest sentence? We were talking about the Atlanta Public School case this past week. Helping us with that is our special guest, attorney Ruth Rocker McMullen. She's a partner in Mull McMullen and Atlanta-based law firm. Ruth represented one of the defendants in the case. She also serves as an adjunct professor at Emory School of Law and also a magistrate judge in Gwinnett County. Ruth, thanks for staying with us during the break.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So Ruth, you know, we want to pick up where we are, at where we left off before the break. But, you know, you shared a couple things of the initial study from survey or research that the Atlanta Journal of Constitution did in 2008, looking at the anomalies, the statistical anomalies across different school systems, or understanding that there's test scores versus the schoolwork, and really just outlining some of these. As you said, there's 69,000 schools in 400 different districts that had these same type of anomalies. And then we also you know, asked the question, really, you know, why Atlanta? And at the same time, we left off talking about these exemplary test scores Atlanta used in order to get this $400 million grant from the federal government. And so Rich really, in a sense, probably perpetuated, you know, started the process, right, of once, I guess, the federal government was asking for that money back because of, irregularities. Could you talk about that? And what's kind of started the whole process?
Well, I think it was just so the Atlanta Journal Constitution's investigation turned up all this, you know, suspicious or peculiar data. And then from there, their stories, it didn't stop with one story. It was multiple stories, multiple articles over a span of months and months and months. Big, huge, attention-grabbing articles. And, you know, they didn't just focus on schools in the state of Georgia or in Atlanta public schools. But at the end, you know, it did lead to questions from the federal government. And it was the state of Georgia, the entire state, that got the $400 million grant. But I think that did lead the federal government to start investigating or start asking questions about what data was provided to secure that grant, which then in turn led the governor to form a commission to investigate these testing irregularities. And, you know, again, that was kind of in response to the federal government questioning the state level about their data. So, and the state level couldn't really provide answers. So they started to do their own investigation. And then that investigation then turned into what was supposed to be an investigation for the governor's task force, then was turned over to the district attorney's office, and where he decided to make this a criminal case.
Wow. Okay. You know, with all those things in mind, Ruth, they did cheat, right?
Some teachers did admit to engaging in cheating.
Sure.
But, you know, in this indictment, there were 35 teachers and administrators indicted.
Mm-hmm.
Several of them at certain schools, entire teachers who were indicted from a certain school, all of them took pleas and admitted to what they did at that one particular school. The 12 defendants who were remaining were the ones who did not enter any type of guilty plea or admit to changing test scores or engaging in cheating.
Okay, got it. So ultimately, those that admitted to changing the test scores, plead out. Is my understanding, or is it a mixture of those getting, sentenced in some form or fashion? How did that play out?
So there was 35 that were indicted, but prior to that, this investigation by the governor's task force went on for about a year or so. So there were even more teachers than that did not get indicted, that were questioned, that gave statements, oftentimes gave conflicting statements, but they were not indicted in this case. And if anyone followed the trial, they were often referred to as unindicted co-conspirators.
Okay.
Because that's another thing with RICO. You can be charged with RICO, and they could use evidence and testimony from a co-conspirator, someone within your organization who was not also charged, to testify against you and prove the point. So there was a whole set of unindicted co-conspirators, and then we had the teachers and administrators who actually got indicted, and out of those 35, I think one passed away and 22 others worked out some sort of plea deal prior to trial.
Okay, and so that leaves the 11.
Right.
Right? That leaves the 11.
Correct.
And so that's what we all saw in the news from that perspective, and I appreciate your knowing the inner workings of this, but you know you can draw conclusions, if you will, along the way. And so were those 11 also accused of being one of the ones that were brought in by Dr. Hall, or also receiving claims of the $200,000-$400,000 each? I think there's some stats somewhere in there. Are those the ones that?
Those 11, those remaining teachers for trial, Dr. Hall was at the top, obviously. But just like the president has a cabinet, she has a cabinet. She has a deputy superintendent and everything. And those people in her cabinet were not indicted. When you hear the news media and the judge and attorneys in the case refer to the top-ranking people, the defendants in the trial, and they singled out three of them as top ranking, they meant top ranking with respect to the other teachers on trial with them. They were not by no means top ranking within this school system. They were mid-level management at best.
I see. Okay.
So there's a whole gap. The top management did not get indicted. The only person in the upper-level management that got indicted was Dr. Hall.
So
correct.
Can the RICO be applied that liberally, I assume?
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because RICO was, keep in mind, RICO was designed for the Gambino family. So it's wide sweeping and as loose as you want to interpret it. Prosecutors then needed to be able to get to the head of the Gambino family by any means necessary, whether it's a little runner on the street or somebody deep within. Whoever's willing to cooperate and give them what they need, that's how they're going to use RICO to get to the top. So,
sure.
Yes, they can pick and choose who they want to charge and who they want to cut deals with prior to charging and who they want to cut deals with after charging.
Sure. You know, you mentioned how the racketeering charges would apply and apply to this particular case. She's literally doing politics. Now you have individuals, we have to address this here, of individuals saying it's applied because of race. What's your thought on that? if you can. I don't want to put you in a corner from that perspective, but I just want to kind of get your perspective on it.
You know, I it's hard to say that it was race, because when you look at it at face value, the district attorney for Fulton County where this happened is African American. The prosecution team was made up of mostly African American. So, you know, it's hard to say that this was a race-based prosecution. What I would lean more towards is that this was more isolated, or they were more identified or scrutinized for because of the social economic background of the neighborhoods in which these schools were. And I say that, and I'm not just throwing stuff out there and trying to shoot from my hip, but, you know, I say that because in this investigation from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, it wasn't just, if you look at a map of the Fulton County or the Atlanta Public Schools and where that Atlanta Public School District is, and if you map out all the schools of all the teachers who were charged, you would see that they were in a certain part of the school district overall, and that these schools served mostly poor neighborhoods. There was a school that was also flagged for having these same statistical anomalies. It was a M. Agnes Jones Elementary School, and it was flagged by the AJC for the same suspicion with the same peculiar data. And the assistant to the teaching, to the testing coordinator at that school, just happened to be the wife of the district attorney. Nobody from that school was charged.
Wow.
This school
okay.
was in a more affluent neighborhood. So if you had to ask me to pick, is it race-based? I would have to say no. I would say it's social, economic-based, and who connections. Again, it's connections.
Wow. Okay. Well, thanks for that perspective. You know, our show is really, my ministry is really about leadership, as you know, and purpose, and as
right.
you as you've known and followed it over the last few years. But my question is, where was the leadership on all of this? Even going back to questioning test scores, or even in this process, or making sure that there was some quality control or quality insurance around this, or even who was really leading this effort, even outside of Dr. Hall, if there was someone.
Well, there is. You know, the way I look at a school system is very much the way I would look at any corporation, and I think that people need to look more at that. Let's look at a corporation, for example, and the corporation has a board of directors, and the board of directors are the ones who hire the CEO, right? And the board of directors has this fiduciary duty to their shareholders, right, the investors. The
right.
shareholders, that they're supposed to do what's right and do right by the company and right by the shareholders. So they take a lot of effort and time, or they're supposed to hire the right CEO to lead this company and to push forward their vision. Well, with a school system, you have the school board. The school board are the elected officials who said to the shareholders are you and me, we're the voters, we're the citizens who live in this school district. We don't even have to be parents of children in the school system. If we live in the school system, we pay our taxes to support the school system. We are the shareholders. So your board of directors for this corporation are the school board. The school board members are the elected officials who are to answer to me as a voter, and they're supposed to hire a CEO, i.e. the superintendent, to do right by the school system. But likewise, just like a board of director has a vision for the CEO or a vision for the company that they want the CEO to kind of implement, the school board has a vision for the school system that they give to their new hire, their CEO, their superintendent. So the school board are the ones who said, we want these test scores to come up. The school board, when they hire a CEO, a superintendent, is the one that says, this is going to be your base pay, but if you show improvement in certain areas that are of concern to us, we will give you a signing. We will give you a bonus to your salary, and the bonus will be whatever amount. They're the ones who set that. That's a contract. That's just an employment contract. So where's the leadership? It goes back to the school board that was elected, that hired her, that set these goals in the first place, that says, we're going to pay you X amount, but if you can help us meet some ridiculously impossible goals in a ridiculously impossible amount of time, we'll pay you more.
You know, I can relate to that, and as I kind of shared with at the beginning of our show tonight, essentially what you're connecting is rewards and metrics incenting the wrong behaviors. You know, you can see it in any type of sales organization where you put a goal. It could be stretch, it could be target, it could be even unrealistic. But if there is enough opportunity, enough pay at the end, will people go over beyond either prudently or imprudently of attaining those goals? And is that what we see here today?
I would say that's what it is. It led to this pressure to meet these targets that were set by the school system. So in turn, this pressure is then turned around and repeated to the principals at these schools. And there was no group meeting with all these principals that says you need to cheat to get these test scores up. It was like a lot of CEOs who manage with iron fists. This is what needs to happen, and I don't want to hear that I can't do it. I don't want to hear any excuses if it doesn't happen. You need to go back to your school, or in a corporate setting, you need to go back to your office and figure out how to make it happen. And don't come to me till it's happened. And if you can't make it happen, I'll find somebody who can. That's the conversation that was had with these principals.
Yep. You know, that's absolutely, you know, one, as we talked about, a root cause of what's happening here when you got misaligned metrics and incentives. You see that in many corporations. You see that each and every day, any client I go to or work with. But what has that exposed about the educational system? What about how have students been impacted by this, not just in Atlanta, but just the whole system itself? What's been exposed?
Well, I think that this is just, it has peeled back the layers to show that the education system is fraught with for-profit means of taking advantage of the children. When you ask who received the stiffest sentence is, what about these other 59,999 schools.
Mm-hmm.
And those children, their test scores and the anomalies have been basically swept under the rug and ignored. What's going to happen there? Because now Atlanta, yeah, they're under a microscope. So they're going to be, you know, doing everything by the book. There's going to be so much public scrutiny every year. Every parent who has a child in the Atlanta public school system is going to scrutinize their children's test scores compared to their grades. And, you know, that this will never happen again in Atlanta. But what about all the other schools? So, and it's nothing new. This happened in first through fifth grade, but it's the same thing with the ACT, the same thing with the SAT, the LSAT, the bar exam, most standardized tests. If there's a way to cheat on it, people do. This is nothing new.
This is nothing new.
And I think it should make us all question, you know, when we go to school and we struggle and fight to send our children, you know, to the top, you know, what we think are the best schools, and then we pay, you know, an exorbitant amount of money to help them go to these top colleges and universities, or they come out of school owing hundreds of thousands of dollars. Did they really get an education?
Right. So which leads to the
taking a
which leads mm-hmm. to the point. It's probably an overdone cliche, but it's still true related to this. Is teaching to the test. Is that part of what, as a result, unintended consequence of this educational system that we somewhat created, trying to really get our hands around, of really preparing a student to pass a test rather than gain a skill set or gain
Absolutely.
Critical thinking.
Absolutely. And these teachers, just like teachers in most school systems, are pressured into teaching to the test. So it doesn't, and what happens there is you teach the children how to take this particular test, but they don't have any skills. They don't have the basis that they need to, I should say, they've learned something in that particular grade. And it's, I know for us adult listeners, you know, elementary school has been so long ago, it's probably hard to conceptualize that. But let's take it to an example I think we can all relate to, a graduate school exam or an exam you have to take after you graduate from school to get your license in a particular field. For example, we have to take the lawyers have to take the bar exam after we finish law school. The bar exam in most states has nothing to do with your practical knowledge of being an attorney. You can pass the bar exam and not know how to draft a motion for court. The bar exam is designed to test how well can you perform under pressure. That's all it is. And if you study and take these expensive bar exam review courses, what you will learn is how can I perform my best under pressure.
Wow.
And that's it. That's all it is.
To that mm-hmm. point, though, there's some of the top colleges to start realizing this. And even as in recent times, we just had a conference with our counsel at Kennedy School, where the SAT or the ACT has even become even more important because some are now thinking the SAT is no accurate predictor of academic success, and some have even dumped them. So why isn't high schools? I know you can't. I don't know if you have an answer for this, but why haven't high schools realized the same thing on the standardized test, or even the government?
Well, you know, because the federal government is too big, and there's too many variables out there for them to actually monitor and receive data. So my opinion is that standardized tests provide administrators and officials with an easy way, a lazy way of gauging the performance. To me, that's the easy way out. Let's just take one big test at the end of the year or sometime that we've spent all year teaching to you, and that's going to tell us how well you can actually perform as an individual. And that's going to give us how well the school is performing. And I think the whole idea of standardized tests is flawed. But I don't know what would schools and the government use in place of that's not going to completely overload them, and there'll be no review because there'll be so much data that they'd have to crunch and analyze that they wouldn't have the manpower to do that.
Yep, no doubt. And even from the perspective, going back to your point of, and where we started from corporations' perspective, corporations – no matter what people think about, it's not a big machine. It's a collection of people and thoughts and ideas and processes and so forth. Deal with this type of complexity each and every day. And mm-hmm. and why wouldn't a school system, federal, state, local, or whatever, partner with corporations who deal with these type of issues? Of having complex data sets, having issues of trying to be transformational, allowing individuals to fail because you have to try new things in order to move forward, and really disconnect this whole metric system that's really inciting these behaviors. Is there room for that type of partnership?
I believe so. I know Harvard has an educational management PhD program that addresses these very issues, the fact that school systems and superintendents that run them should view their school systems not as a school but as a corporation and learn to analyze data and learn project management from the standpoint of a corporate world as opposed to from just teaching and how can we do this from a teaching background or an education background. I don't know that that change is going to come anytime soon, but I think that it's starting to make progress and it's starting to make sense to people that the standard that we're using and the methodology that's being used across the nation is not working. And something's going to have to change or it's all going to implode on itself.
You know, what is this the catalyst? If I am a leader in Georgia or Atlanta or anywhere education system, even the Secretary of Education, this is the platform, this is the issue, the part of this is the opportunity to say, okay, we need to fix this. Because if there are almost 69,000 schools are dealing with the same issue, our kids are in trouble.
Right.
Again, it goes back to the question, where's the leadership on this?
You know, I encouraged my client to apply to this PhD program at Harvard. I said, you know, I encouraged her. She worked on her case. All felony charges against her were reduced to misdemeanors, and she's almost finished with her probation. So when she's finished, she will not be a convicted felon. She's not a convicted felon now. And, you know, I told her there's two ways that you can deal with the rest of your life going forward. You can tuck your tail and disappear into oblivion and live an anonymous life, hoping no one ever recognizes you or recognizes your name, or you can embrace what has happened as a tremendously important teaching moment and do something about it. She and what she went through and what she experienced is exactly why Harvard created this educational management PhD program. She has lived the disaster that they predict will happen. So I, in my mind, and I'm not an admissions counselor, but in my mind, she's perfect for their program. Talking about adding a diverse perspective and interesting dialogue to their class, you have a student who has lived it and lived through it. So I encourage her to apply, and my hope is that she will take me up on that encouragement. I even offered to write one of her letters of recommendation because I said, you know, wherever you go, people can do a Google search of your name and find it all out. That's never going to disappear. So you might as well stand tall and say, yes, this happened, and this is what I've learned, and this is what I want to do from it. And I truly hope that to see her as a superintendent of a school system someday, because she now knows what not to do.
What not to do. Wow, that's great. So Ruth, we're going to take a quick break. We got some questions coming in, and want to make sure we get to those. And so after the break, we'll continue our dialogue with special guest Atlanta attorney Ruth Rocker McMullen, who's here to help us answer the question of the day, who received the stiffest sentence. So feel free to call us at 310-861-2331. We'd love to hear from you, friends. This is On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back.
Where they are by getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on the queue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the art of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is makes the leader in you come alive.
And we're back. Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Remember, our mission here is simple, friends, to help you leave what you are by getting on cue with God's will. So today's question of the day, who received the stiffest sentence? Helping us with that is our special guest, Ruth Rocker McMullen. She's a partner at Mullen and McMullen, Atlanta-based law firm. She represented one of the defendants in this case with Atlanta Public Schools recently. She also serves as adjunct professor at Emory School of Law and also magistrate judge in Gwinnett County. So, Ruth, thanks for staying with us this Sunday evening.
Thank you.
You know, we've covered a lot of ground. I think we've also saw the educational system issue as well. But we'll continue to press on. But you know, before we got a few more points we want to cover with you. But however, I want to give an opportunity for some questions that we have. We have one on Facebook, and Kennedy's going to ask that one.
Hi, Mrs. McMullen. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Well, this person asked, if bonuses were not offered, would the level and amount of grade change taking place?
The question was, were bonuses offered?
If bonuses were not offered, would the level and amount of grade changing taken place?
Would have taken place.
The reality is the majority of these teachers who end up getting charged did not receive bonuses. The ones who did, their bonuses were around $500 for the entire school year. And they may have gotten a bonus for more than 1 year because the cheating scandal, the data went on for several years. So, you know, many of them, no, they got no bonuses at all, and some of the bonuses were around $500. So when you take $500 for a year and take the taxes off of that and divide the remainder by 12 months, you could probably buy yourself a cup of coffee maybe twice that month from Starbucks. So the bonuses, the few that received bonuses were very insignificant in the grand picture. Certainly weren't $500,000 in bonuses.
Right. So
the pressure
so talk
to achieve
about
is not
the
from
one,
money.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Say that one more time.
The pressure to cheat was not for money. These people were threatened with losing their jobs if they didn't show and prove. Just use some, you know, street slang, show and prove. That's what they were told. You have to show and prove. I want numbers. I want, you know, your class has to pass. It wasn't about, well, if you pass, we'll give you a nice cushy bonus. If your children don't pass, you're going to lose your job.
Sure. Sure. So it related to that, and maybe I'm making a huge assumption and a leap here, and I know it's not always a good thing to do when we got a great lawyer on the call, of reason why the 11 was focused on, and I got a text in to say, you know, that 11 showed a level of arrogance and pride, and why wouldn't they take the plea?
You know, and I think that's an interesting perspective that I've heard several people. I've seen it on social media, and I've read it in comments on news articles and stuff, that they were arrogant and prideful. To me, that thought smacks of an inherent racism or an assumption about race in the criminal justice system that many people, black and white, have. If these educators were Caucasian, would that same comment be made, that they're arrogant, as opposed to vehemently protesting their innocence? Our assumption is when you're black and you're accused, you must be guilty. And so, you know, not just these educators, hundreds of thousands of, you know, defendants every day. When you stand before this jury and you're black and you're accused, you must have done something. So you should just go ahead and save us all this time and admit it. And when you don't, you're being arrogant. Lord forbid that we would actually be innocent. And the almost daily news of somebody else being exonerated and taken off a death row and released from prison after 25 years because they were actually innocent still does not resonate with people. And those men stood there 25, 30 years ago vehemently protesting their innocence, and everyone assumed they were being arrogant and thought that they could skirt the law and play the games and game the system. And now these men are being returned free, innocent, proven innocent. So I don't know. You know, I can't say that they're arrogant. They honestly and genuinely are fighting for their innocence and fighting for exoneration.
Well, thanks for sharing that great point and great way to add a perspective to that dialogue. We're coming up on our time, and I know we've already highlighted two different shows that we could potentially do in the future, and I'm definitely going to hold you. But before we get to some closing comments, what didn't I ask that I should have? What haven't we said?
I guess the one thing is these teachers that were convicted, there's a first grade teacher. They accused her of giving out practice tests. Who are these individual teachers? And what did they do? What were their lives like? Who are they in this big picture? Do you know, and I guess what you don't know, and what a lot of people don't know, is with a couple of exceptions, the CRCT, passing or failing that alone, does not determine whether a student is promoted to the next grade. In the third grade, you do have to pass the reading portion, and in the fifth grade, you do have to pass the CRCT to be promoted. Do you know that these teachers who got convicted were first, second, and fourth grade teachers? So the test that they're accused of cheating on was not the sole criteria for whether these children passed or not.
Wow. So in the big scheme of things, it wasn't crucial and a requirement in the primary.
Right.
Interesting. And so even from the perspective, let's pick up that point real quick. Actually, not necessarily changing the test, but ultimately just something very small like saying, check your answers, those types of things. Can you talk about that?
Right. So some of the allegations were that teachers told the children to change their answers when what the teachers said they said was, they'd walk up and down the classroom, and if anyone's finished early, go back and review your answers. Go back and proofread. Check your answers over again. Somehow that's been interpreted as you need to go back and change some answers. Now, I mean, we can all remember taking standardized tests and seeing our teacher walking up and down the hall, up and down the aisles of our classroom. And if you finished and put your pencil down and put your head down and time isn't up, they would tap you on your shoulder as they're talking to the entire class and say, if you finished early, you need to go back and check your answers.
Hmm.
And the tap on the shoulder is the indicator that I'm talking to you. We've all been there.
Sure, absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing that. You've been great, a wealth of information and a wealth of perspective. We definitely appreciate that tonight. But I just want to turn it back on you for our last few questions. How do we support you? How do we find you in your practice and in your work?
Well, you can always find me at our firm's website. It's MullenMcMullen.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm pretty sure if you just did a Google search of my name, it would all come up. Right now I'm enjoying my practice as a judge and taking on some appellate work. The teachers themselves, because my client, worked out a plea deal, so she's long before this case went to trial. So in this particular case, she's moved on with her life. I hate to say it, but most people, I tell people, I do criminal defense, so you really don't want to have to call me because that's usually a bad sign.
But
if there is something that comes up in your life and in personal lives or family or friends, I'm always happy to help and give people my perspective if they need just somebody to bounce their concerns off of, and if it ends up being more, then so be it. I know the teachers are working on coming up with a fund to fund their appeals, and I believe that the county has paired up with Dr. Bernice King, and they're working on coming up with an agency to assist the children who were taught in these particular classes at these particular schools.
Wow. Actually getting to the root of things. Well, thanks for sharing that. You know, one of our last questions, you know, what can we be in prayer with you about, Ruth?
You know, I would just say that I think as a whole, the listeners should pray for this situation to not end with the lives of these teachers being affected. I'd hope that the dialogue would be sparked, like you say, and that some genuine, honest change in the education system, not just in Atlanta Public Schools, but nationwide, starts to develop from this, because this cannot continue.
This cannot continue. And with that, we thank you for sharing with us tonight and time away from the family, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It was an enjoyable reprieve.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for saying that, because it's nothing like just sharing information. And even for me, I had formed some opinions that I've strayed away from based upon what you shared here tonight. And so even probably going to have to change my clothing because of what you shared.
Well, good. So I still have it. I got that power of persuasion.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, well, thank you. This is attorney Ruth Rocco McMullen. She is, as you know, very, very persuasive, as you could tell, and she's been great for sharing some good perspectives around the Atlanta public school situation. And you know, she's a wealth of information. You can also find her, again, mullmcmullen.com, and also her link is also on our Facebook and also our website page. So feel free, again, if you have the need to call her, reach out to her, please do. But as she said, you probably don't want to call her because it may be not the right situation. But so friends, thanks for staying with us, and I hope we've got a lot of good information from our guest tonight. You know, when I started the show about, you know, what are the keys to success is really putting the right people in the right places and empowering them with the right authority to make these decisions. Again, as I shared, the opposite was true of what's key to failure. Again, putting the wrong people in the right places and empower them with the right authority to make those decisions. You know, again, people begin to make decisions and begin to fail. And yet there's no doubt there was some tests changing. There's some changes in these test scores and so forth. And really what leads to the point I would have shared earlier about the two reasons things began to fail was one incompetence, the other was imprudence. And making these decisions based upon metrics or even based upon keeping your job and securing your family, and that right there in itself is just a failure of leadership, bad ethics. Those things can be somewhat trained away from an imprudence perspective, but from an incompetence perspective, you can train up an individual, you can send them to Harvard, you can send them all sorts of ways when it comes to incompetence. But the imprudence piece is what I want to tag on here today. I just don't think the imprudence can be trained away. And it cannot be separated from me from God's goodness. And I said it again, it just cannot be separated from God's goodness. But just like the challenges in life and as well as in the whole, this failure of leadership is really at the root of what we're talking about. If it's establishing a system standardized test, if it's not teaching critical thinking, if it's forcing individuals to really make decisions based upon certain metrics in place, are not having the right processes in order to equip, or even being selective because of socioeconomic conditions and so forth along the way. You know, there's a lot of variety of things that apply here, but also apply broadly. Some things we have to stop doing. We were in our Greater Is He series, but we left this Stop Doing series based in Proverbs 17. I think I just need to bring that back just a little bit today, and to help answer our question today, which is, who received the stiffest sentence? In our mind, it's the kids. The kids are losing and have the stiffest sentence. If you look at the spots across America where these anomalies may be happening,
who are really getting to the root of these things when it comes to education. Proverbs 17:6 says, share that the children's children are the crown to the age and the parents are the pride of their children. We've seen a lost sight on the real purpose of what this system is all about, not necessarily of getting federal funds in order to fund the school, but it's really educating our children. And the future generation is really our purpose. We've lost sight on that, of making sure that we're preparing people, our kids and everyone involved for life, not preparing for a test or government funding or a personal bonus, which also leads to the Proverbs 17:16, where it's of what use is money in the hands of fools, since he has no desire to get wisdom. And scripture shares that money is the root of evil, but some say that money changes people, but I believe money sometimes makes people more of what they already are. But at the same time, in certain cases like this, when you put pressures so forth on individuals' families, they will sacrifice integrity and sacrifice ethics in order to take care of them. And that's some of the situations, especially some of the teachers, the first and second grade teachers that our guest Ruth shared here during our show. You know, we really have to also break part of this transformation we're talking about, the education system, where we sit in corporate America, so forth, in so many different ways. We really have to break this, what we call the stewardship of the status quo. And even the one of the ladies who were asked to get involved in this process refused to participate, and she was one of the ones that broke that status quo. Instead of going with the status quo, like some of the teachers' administrators who did exactly what Proverbs 17:18 said, was a man lacking in judgment strikes the hand in pledge and puts up security for his neighbor. And this is exactly what some of the leaders did for this element. Of course, as we shared, they were after Dr. Beverly Hall, but ultimately pledged themselves into this scheme and not really paying for, and now they're paying for the security, the freedom, the livelihood of the family. And instead of pledging ourselves to things that are not of God, are not of spirit, not of truth, you know, we, our generation is reaping what we're sowing. We're sowing seeds that from the store that is part of he that's in the world. And then we have allowed political and social pressures to separate our children from the love that is in Christ. When you just pick any situation from a culture, education, political, from that perspective, it is politically incorrect in order to talk about the word and help kids use that in order to grow and prosper in their own lives. And when we receive, who will receive the stiffest sentence at the end of the day? We will, if we don't do something to begin to plant the seeds that are greater that is he, where we can truly say what in 1 John 4:4 said, in earnest, greater is he is in the world that is in me that he is in the world. I'll say that again, 1 John 4:4, and we can be able to say that in earnest, greater is he that is in me than he is in the world. Once we're able to do that and keep that compass in place, we can start solving some of these problems. I know it's somewhat idealistic, but we know what the Lord can change things if we decide to follow and keep in our hearts and minds and spirit. No matter where we are, we can transform any educational system, a societal system, in a government system, or even in your household, in your churches, and know if we anchor ourselves in the greater is he. So with that, we thank you. We thank for our special guest, Ruth Rocker McMullen, who's gave us some great insight. And until next week, we live, Lord spare. We look forward to seeing you and talking with you. Until then, Kennedy's going to close it out.
Before we go, we thank our special guest, Ruth Rocker McMullen. We thank you for tuning in. We hope that our ministry helps you get on cue with the Lord. I have an ask for all of you. Put us on your prayer list, like us on Facebook at On Cue Radio, and follow us on Twitter at Cue Leadership, and invite a friend to listen to this show and to next week's show. If you're a leader in the church, on the field, at work, at home, in the community, or anywhere, consider us to enhance your leadership. For more information, go to our website, www.qleadership.org or .com. If you would like to be a sponsor, please email us at onq@qleadership.com. Also, purchase my dad's book, The Leader in the Mirror, released on February 5th. We give all honor and praise to Christ our Savior. I'm sure my dad thanks his producer assistant, me, his better half, best friend and wife, my mom, my little sister Carson, of our family, friends, and life on Facebook. This has been On Cue Radio. Until next week, get on cue with God's will, get on cue with God's calling on your life, and get others on cue with that calling.
How do you lead a people who are starved, who are broken, who are isolated?
You lead them where they are, by getting them on cue for God's will, by getting them on cue for His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on cue.
Let us help you get on cue.